Lessons from Flight 1549. Today, First Officer Jeffrey Skiles. I'm Paul Platt, and this is Aero News. Welcome into the Aero News special feature, and thanks for downloading us today. Last week, in the first installment of this series, we presented the comments of U.S. Airways Captain Chesley Sullenberger before the House Aviation Subcommittee as he recalled the ditching of Flight 1549 in the Hudson River. Today, you'll hear from First Officer Jeffrey Skiles in edited remarks from his testimony on February 24th.
Now the chair recognizes First Officer Skiles.
Thank you, Chairman Costello and ranking members Micah and Petri. And members of the committee, I'm also honored to appear before the Aviation Subcommittee today. I'm going to summarize my statement, which I've already submitted. I think the word of the day today is experience, obviously, looking at us. I myself have 20,000 flying hours. I've been a captain at U.S. Airways in the past, but due to cutbacks, I'm flying as first officer right now, and I've been flying for 32 years myself. Much has been made of the cockpit crew and our participation in this, but I think it would be remiss if I didn't acknowledge once again the fantastic contribution that Donna Dent, Doreen Welsh, and Sheila Dale made to the successful outcome that day. And also the captains and crews of the ferry boats, the first responders, air traffic controllers. Obviously, in the press, they're calling us heroes, but there were a whole lot of heroes on that day. Our profession carries a tremendous responsibility. And this has brought into me a renewed appreciation for the fact that this is a serious job for serious people. We have dedicated our lives to this profession, and it appears as if on that particular day we are five people in the right place at the right time. Sully and I have 70 years and 40,000 hours of flying between us, and the flight attendants have many, many years between them. In fact, if I told you, you would probably investigate U.S. Air for violating child labor laws on the day that they were hired. One of our concerns, though, is that this is something that's fading from our industry. Newly hired pilots at our affiliate carriers have as little as 300 flying hours when they start work. When I was hired, it required 3,000 hours to even be considered for an interview. What the country has experienced financially in the last 8 months, we've experienced for the last 8 years in our industry since 9-1-1. Financial turmoil, bankruptcies, layoffs, and revolving door management teams have decimated our airlines and our careers. I myself make about half of what I once made, and I have lost my retirement to a PBGC promise. Many pilots work two jobs. I myself am a general contractor. Sully does consulting. We work 7 days a week, and we split our focus between our two careers to maintain our middle-class lifestyles. When I was hired in this business, there were airline dynasties. Whole families were employed in the aviation business. You'd fly with a captain, he might have five children, they were all were pilots, flight attendants, agents. Now I know of no one that encourages their children to go into aviation. We're extremely grateful for the outpouring of support and gratitude that we've received. But we do feel a responsibility to our fellow pilots to advocate for them. Our labor negotiation system does not work. We're not looking for special privileges, but we're looking for a level playing field. The balance of power has shifted greatly, and the state of the piloting profession is the proof. National Mediation Board negotiations drag on forever. We would ask that you look at possible reforms of the National Mediation Board and also the Railway Labor Act that we work under. Our colleagues have rallied around us in this, and we believe that we showed what well-trained professional crews can do in times of crisis. And we're gratified that our colleagues in aviation seem to look at us as a positive reflection of themselves and our shared professions. We ask that Congress take seriously the challenges that we aviation professionals face. And we ask that Congress work with us to protect our professions so that in the future we can attract the best and the brightest to be pilots and flight attendants in America. Thank you.
In a moment, we'll be back for part of the Q&A with the House Aviation Subcommittee and Flight 1549 First Officer Jeffrey Skiles. I'm Paul Plack, and you're listening to a special feature from Aero News.
You hear that sound? It's one of the all-time great inventions. Takes lids off cans just like that. But now, let's picture something even bigger. A tool that can take the lid off a whole airport. Actually, thousands of airports. It's a Garmin WAAS GPS. Lets you make glide path approaches using runways that were once closed tight during IFR conditions. Hey, if you're gonna fly in the soup, you gotta have an opener. Garmin WAAS GPS. Follow the leader.
Diamond Aircraft's D-Jet is the ultimate private aircraft for the owner-flown market, offering simplicity of operation, safety, and affordability. Imagine starting the turbine with a simple push of a button. Push the single-lever throttle forward. Monitor your flight on the cutting-edge G1000 with integrated autopilot and enjoy the reliability, performance, smoothness, and quiet of turbine power. Visit Diamond on the web at www.diamondair.com or call 888-359-3222.
Welcome back to the Aero News special feature, Lessons from Flight 1549. After his opening statement, First Officer Jeffrey Skiles answered a few questions from the House Aviation Subcommittee.
Chair now recognizes the ranking member of the subcommittee, Mr. Petrak.
Thank you very much. Being from Wisconsin, I represent a place called the Horican Marsh. We have enormous number of geese. They used to migrate. They're called Canadian geese. They're supposed to go down south. And unfortunately, in recent time, for a variety of reasons, including hatching these geese and releasing hatchlings into the flock to supplement it, thinking that they would migrate with the others, they don't. They don't know how to migrate, many of them. They stay around. Do you think as part of this we should be thinking about clearing the ones that don't migrate off the land? They're a mess for aviation. They're bad for golf courses and recreation and lawns. These creatures are turning into enormous pests, and they're a huge danger to life. Or is that overkill from a goose's point of view? Do any of you have any comment on that? Have you seen this sort of real rare experience, or are these creatures around a constant threat? They're pretty big. I mean, they're not just small birds.
Well, as you know, sir, I'm from Wisconsin as well, and I drive by the Horican Marsh several times a year on camping trips up to the Door County area. And you're right, you do see an awful lot of geese in that area, but you see geese everywhere. I mean, there's so many of them, they seem to have really exploded in population lately. But I guess personally, I still do think that this was an extremely rare event that may never recur. Just the chance of, hitting them, them being in just the wrong place and us being in just the wrong place, I think it's just a fluke that... this may never recur again, even if we do nothing about them. And frankly, there's so many of them, I don't know what we would do at this point.
And I think, finally, I'd be remiss if I didn't give you an opportunity. Several of you in your prepared statements talked about the pressure that the airline industry has been on since 9/11 and really before, since deregulation, and the implications for the profession of being a pilot and for the airlines and so on. Do you have any particular suggestions or areas you think we should be looking on to help increase the chances that we will maintain professionalism in the industry going forward, which, as you pointed out, has been under pressure right now?
Well, the two things that I would suggest is, as I mentioned in my statement, labor relations seem to go on, or contract negotiations seem to go on absolutely indefinitely. And, of course, the bankruptcies have just decimated the contracts that we used to have. What we really need is to have a finite timetable within the National Mediation Board process, so that they just cannot go on interminably the way they do now, to allow us to rebuild these professions, to make it something that people will aspire to and that people want to do again. The other suggestion I might have is the Railway Labor Act itself, which we have to work under actually protects railroads much better than it does airlines. In our case, while we have all the disadvantages of the negotiated process within the Railway Labor Act, we do not have the protections to our contracts that the Railway Labor Act does provide for railroads, in that it's very easy just to abrogate our contracts as aviation professionals. If we were working for a railroad, they would actually have to negotiate any kind of changes to the contracts, even under the Railway Labor Act.
Chair, thanks. The ranking member now recognizes the gentleman from New York, Mr. Hall.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Based on your experience, are there any aircraft design issues that could be reexamined, perhaps to make water landings safer or more feasible?
Well, there are a number of items that you have to go through. It's actually designed more for doing at high altitude. If you just had a dual flame out for whatever reason, maybe you flew through volcanic ash or you had a fuel interruption. So it's actually very long, very lengthy, and, of course, given the time frame, we were only able to get about to the bottom of the first page. But the items that we did accomplish basically ensure that we have electrical and hydraulic power to the aircraft even while we're in a glide. And then we try to we have a engine master switch, which resets some of the computers. It's a lot like your computer at home. When it starts to act up, you reboot it, and that's essentially what you're doing there. You're trying to reboot the engine because it's actually controlled by computers. But that's about as far as we got before we actually performed the ditching.
And have either you or Captain Sullenberger had been in the cockpit on flights that had bird strikes previously that were survivable?
Well, a bird strike is not, it's a rare, but it's not a particularly unusual circumstance. I would imagine that just about any pilot that has flown for any length of time it has encountered bird strikes, but normally it's a seagull or a small bird that doesn't even dent the airframe. It might just, the mechanic might just come out and clean the blood off the nose. That's normally the kind of bird strikes that you have.
But keys in both engines are unlikely to leave the turbines functioning.
Well, that's something for the NTSB to determine in their investigation, but it's certainly a bigger bird than I've ever hit before.
Right. Well, thank you once again, and congratulations, and the country's very grateful to you all.
You've been listening to selected portions of the testimony of U.S. Airways Flight 1549 First Officer Jeffrey Skiles before the House Aviation Subcommittee on February 24th. In our next installment, we'll hear from Patrick Harton, an air traffic controller in the New York TRACON, whose calm voice you hear in the recordings of radio communications from the Miracle on the Hudson. You've been listening to Lessons from Flight 1549, a special feature from AeroNews. Find us on the web at www.aero-news.net. I'm Paul Platt. Thanks for listening. Have a clear and unlimited day.